This podcast is brought to you by the first Autodesk Cave, which will bring together wildly creative people. Cave speakers include Sid Mead, who brings futurism and believability to movies such as Blade Runner, Tron, and Star Trek. Neil Gaiman, the creator and writer of the cult DC comic series Sandman. John Cleese, a versatile comic actor and leading business motivator, and many, many more. Find out more at AutodeskCave.com. Hi, welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, episode 175, and by Grapthorpe's mighty hammer, the sons of Warven, we shall be... Oh, wait, that's Galaxy Quest. No, sorry, wrong hammer. No, we're doing Thor the Dark World, and joining me this week via the Skype recording device is Matt Wallen. How are you, Matt?
Great. Happy to be here to talk about Thor 2.
Now, Matt, we've done a couple of episodes that have been via kind of vision and stuff. We're going back to audio. And a reason for this is that people complained about you and I on the quality of the audio-only version of the Hangouts we were doing. Now, when I say complain, I really mean I genuinely pointed out that they thought that the audio wasn't up to scratch, which it wasn't because of the beta testing nature of what we were doing with our... So what I thought we'd do this week is we're going to do the Thor episode because we've had some delays trying to solve some of those problems. So we thought we'd go back and do a classic episode as we are today with just audio. And then when we've got all the audio solved, we'll then go back to doing the Google Hangout versions, knowing that the audio feed that you might be listening to right now as a podcast would be up to scratch. So the reason I mention this is not to sound bitter or twisted, because I'm absolutely not. I think it's completely terrific that people emailed us in, Matt. But it was a good experiment, and we want to do more. But by the same token, we totally respect the fact that if you are only listening to the podcast, it's kind of annoying if the audio isn't up to scratch. And joining Matt and I is Ian Fales. How are you, Ian?
Good, Mike. How are you going?
Good, good. Now, Ian, let's start with the show, the film itself. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah. I had a lot of fun. I'm a fan of the first film, and I think I walked into this film thinking that where else could they go? And in the end, I didn't care too much about where they went. I just enjoyed the fact that the film was funny. In the audience I saw it with, there was just a lot of laughter, which... The film's already a little bit fantastical and magical, or the concept of Thor is, but I didn't realize how much I would laugh at the film.
Now, Matt, are you Team Loki or Team Thor?
Well, I probably would have to be Team Thor just because I have a son who shares that name. But
Could you just clarify that for us? Are you that much of a fan of the comic book that you named your son after a Marvel comic? And has Marvel approached you for copyright infringement?
No. My last name is Swedish. It's actually Wallin. And there's a bunch of weird names in my family background. Like there's a few Yens. There's a Juno. And so when our son was born, my wife and I were thinking of names, and we thought we would go with one of the sort of Swedish or Norse sounding names, and Thor was the one that came to the top of the pile. So I don't know.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. And it's cool. He's kind of got his glasses. I figure he could be really nerdy, or he could be like, the drummer in like a metal band, and either way it would probably work out pretty good.
I think it'd be pretty good also as a, linebacker, right? I mean, I think the options are pretty much open there. Hey, so my wife actually lived in Sweden for a couple of years, speaks fluent Swedish. I've got to say, a big soft spot in our world for anything Swedish or Norse or anything vaguely even Scandinavian in any way, shape or form. Hey, so getting back to the film... I have two girls, so they are absolutely Team Loki. Oh, my God. Marvelous girls that they are. They actually got to meet the actor when he was in Sydney. And, boy, that was a let's just say that, I understand what Beatlemania must have been like. But we were biased by this, I guess, because Loki is so popular. But I would say I'm probably one of the only ones. Ian, Loki seems to have developed as a character far beyond what maybe he may have done from the first original Thor film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's Tom Hiddleston, isn't it, himself as an actor. But I don't think people realized after Thor and Avengers that Loki was going to be so, like, such a loved villain. You know, because that, I mean, he is a villain, but he's kind of really the most popular villain around. And I think I even heard that on this film, they kind of added in more scenes with Loki, either probably at the script stage, but
No, they did. In fact, they went back and added stuff not at the script stage after principal photography had started. In fact, listening to the director talk about it, he was saying that the director of this film had also done terrific work on Game of Thrones as one of the directors on Game of Thrones. Obviously, in an episodic television environment, you have multiple directors for the series. Obviously, in a feature film, you don't normally. And so he was saying the big difference between Game of Thrones and this, and you'd expect him to say budget, you know, scope, blah, blah, blah. He's like, we normally have a finished script beforehand. in fact, I go so far as to say he recounted a story of Joss Whedon being pulled out, as you know, he's Marvel's go-to guy after directing Avengers. And apparently he directed this entire, wrote this entire scene on kind of when he joined the production. And the you know, the sentiment as he was walking out the door was awesome. Thanks so much. This is Alan Taylor talking, the director. Do you mind writing this next scene? so I think that now look, is that a problem? Does it really matter? I think we get a little bit too inside baseball on what happens on films these days. It really just matters what it's like when you're sitting in the seat, and certainly I didn't feel like it was a disjointed plot or just a mismatch of ideas. In fact, there have been some other films, I guess World War Z, which took much more of a left turn, that you could really see the point at which the film went from where it was going to a rewrite, and that third act in World War Z was huge. I'm sure you'd agree, guys, but this one felt pretty good in terms of just a general Marvel story arc.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I think, you know, it was definitely an interesting and unusual movie. I thought on a number of levels, it did feel like, I think what you said earlier, Ian, was true. It's like, where do you go after the first film and the Avengers? And, you know, where did they go? Well, they went back to, you know, basically to Asgard for most of the movie. And I think, you know, that was an interesting shift and an interesting choice to make. And, you know, I think a Thor movie in general, and the character of, at least the Marvel character of Thor, it's a complicated and I think a difficult character around which to create a whole movie. I think the complexities of both the kind of, you know, the sort of overwrought kind of almost Shakespearean-esque language and the enunciation, and then the just sort of the absurdity of some of the costumes and the world and whatnot. I mean, it's a tall ask, you know, to be able to create and make a film that something that doesn't go too far overboard into like extreme camp, you know. And I think the last time we talked about the first Thor movie, I remember saying that, you know, it reminds me, and it still does, I can't escape it, it reminds me so much of the Dino De Laurentiis Flash Gordon. You know, it has this kind of like over the top kind of the costumes and the art direction and stuff, although it's not quite as campy as all that, but it comes so close to that line. And I think when they do insert humor into the story and a kind of a playfulness, they can get back to the serious stuff, but when they insert humor, I think that's when, for me, this franchise anyway, is at its strongest, when it feels like it's having a little bit of fun, you know?
I think that I couldn't agree with you more. I think the first film was one that I really wanted to like, and I think Kenneth Branagh is just a really great, you know, like actor, and his Henry V is, you know, they just rip up Shakespeare's manuscript because they don't need to make another film of that. And yet, as much as Kenneth Branagh is just very high in my kind of, you know, status of directors, and I don't know where it came from, I thought the first film was ridiculous in its costuming and makeup. It was like an ABBA, you know, Eurovision Song Contest meets glam rock, you know, Gary Glitter disaster area of just ridiculous, absolutely stupid outfits. And it wasn't just the outfits that I thought were stupid. I thought the whole world lacked a believability. I saw it in getting ready for this one. And it's just as stupid. I mean, it's just like, honestly, the environment in the second film and the grounding of the costumes and taking Loki's stupid horns off and getting rid of some of the 29-inch, you know, wings of shoulder pads that Thor wore, it's just such a dramatic improvement. But the environment is also better. There's a shot, and I remember sighing to myself, oh, thank the Lord for that, when they go to like a bar kind of area to celebrate a battle in this film. And there's like an area where people are sitting down and can actually, you know, live. And there's a waterfall and it feels like a kind of bar slash, you know, place that people would hang out. It's almost like an advanced mall slash, you know, community place. And then there's places where you'd imagine a horse might be able to actually run free. And in the first film, when a horse appeared, I was like, where the hell are you keeping the horse? There's no grass anywhere. I mean, it was just like a glass, plastic bubble of horrible glitter bands gone wrong in the first film. Even though there were some other really good bits in the first film, right? Just that art direction-y stuff. Is there a big shift? I mean, there's a shift in the cinematographer. There's obviously a shift in the director. I'm hoping that it was a different art director. Does anyone know if the art director or production designer changed? Because the first one was somebody called Paul, if I remember. I remember looking him up thinking, what had he done? Do anyone know who the production... Yes, the production designer is has changed in this one. In fact, I think most of the creative team around it has changed. So I don't mean to be really nasty for Paul Reuben, who's... Well, okay, I am being nasty, but he's done other good films. But yeah. Transformers, Miami Vice, Peter Pan, Battleship. This guy is really... No, actually, I'm talking about the wrong person. Yes.
I think you're right, Mike.
I apologize. Joe Walsh was the production designer. I was just talking about the editor. The production designer was, oh, I'm sorry, he's a much better thing. Space Chimps. Great. Which planet are you from? Chimps. Wild, Wild West. Yeah. So this is a guy that's just really in touch with his inner. Okay. He also was production designer on Edward Scissorhands and Grand Canyon. So. And then he takes a left turn at Batman Returns. So I got to figure at some point he had his heart broken by somebody in costume and it's just some kind of weird revenge. But I just, how could somebody that worked on The Color Purple as an art director go on to be the art director of Thor 1? That is just incomprehensible. Did he have like, somebody broke this man's heart. Somebody, honestly, this really ruined him some point in his career in the late 90s.
I just think it's such a big ask, you know. I think that, you know, you look at something like the other films in the sort of the Marvel universe and you look at, you know, Iron Man is it's kind of cool, right? He's like a modern high-tech knight or something, right, with his armor and all the technology. And then when he's not in that getup, he's like James Bond or something. He's like, you know, millionaire playboy guy or whatever. And that's just, it's just cool. It's not anything that's too hard to arrive at. I think Captain America, excuse me, is equally difficult. Although I think Joe Johnston in the first film, at least with the beginnings of how he dealt with the overwrought and absurd costume of Captain America, I thought was clever and achieved a certain kind of success. And I think with a character...
Well, plus Captain America had the best visual effects in the, you know, in the skinny...
Yeah, with the skinny Steve, yeah.
I would have forgiven that film for anything after the... Honestly, like the drink the bathwater of the visual effects team that did the opening shrinking of that.
And
that is to this day...
It's still
just
so
spectacular.
Great.
Spectacular.
Yeah, and I think...
But no, I totally agree. It's a really hard ask because... But wasn't it a hard ask always? I mean, I'm not a huge comic book guy, but like when I was a kid, Thor always seemed like the odd Marvel guy out. He was the... You know, God of Thunder, where everybody else seemed to be kind of much more somebody that just happened to have run across a good vat of radioactive.
But I agree. And I think what the only thing, well, or one of the only things I think that makes the character work is Chris Hemsworth. I think he's so.
Oh, yeah.
He's so charismatic and he's so fun to watch. And, you know, he's cool. He has a great sense of humor. I mean, I loved him in. In Rush, and I'm super excited to hear that he's in the Heart of the Sea, the new film as well. But I mean, I just thought
I agree. He was really good in this.
Yeah, I thought, I mean, he makes the movie worth watching, and he makes the character, you know, human in a way, right, for a god, I guess, and compelling. I think without him in that role, you wouldn't have a movie. He's got star power, and he makes it work.
And it's not and just like, the straight just, guy. Sorry, you're gone.
I was just going to say, like you say, it's a bit of a hard ask because of what Thor is. But on this film, you're right. They seem to have made it a bit more gritty, and you know, Asgard feels more lived in and sort of more part of the environment. And then, you know, there's that. And then I think also by sort of having that humor and a bit of tongue-in-cheek stuff, it does make it feel more humanized as much as it can be. And
yeah,
and maybe they just did a better job of that than they did on the first film.
I think there are a lot of intelligent decisions made in these areas. And obviously we'll get onto visual effects in a second. But like one of the things is like, well, they explain why there's only one Asian guy in Asgard, right? Which, you know, quite frankly, if I'd been an Asian American, I'd kind of been almost offended by the, you know, and certainly, you know, you want to feel like there are multiple realms that people have come from and they just aren't sort of a token representative. I mean, I think the actor that plays that character is great, but I'm just saying like, there were some odd things in the first one that just were more accounted for in the second one that just were intelligent decisions all around. But that one bit, I think it's even in the trailer where Chris Hemsworth does Thor smashing up that kind of rock-ish monster and then just does that single, you know, anyone else line. I mean, he delivers that and there's nothing else to support that joke, just his power of personality. And you go, yeah, that guy's really knocking it out of the park. Of course, he's surrounded by other good actors, right? I mean, Anthony Hopkins is a really good actor.
Sure,
Natalie
sure.
Portman is a really good actress. There's no question that there's depth in the acting. I was glad to see Rene Russo do a little bit more in this one as well.
Well, and Idris Elba too. Like, again, I mean, he got to do so much. I actually didn't know that was him in the first movie, and I'm a huge fan of his. I was like, who is that guy? Like, and in this one, he seemed to have much more to do, and also it was more obviously him. He got to take off his, you know, giant gold helmet for a time too. So there's a great supporting cast across the board.
I've got to say, and just before we get to the visual effects, that shot of at Stonehenge, you know, when he's running around naked, that was just knockdown funny. I was really had me rolling, and I just thought it was genuinely super funny. So okay. So we liked the film, and it didn't disappoint, and certainly it corrected a lot of issues from the first one, and of course dealt with this incredibly difficult problem of whenever you have a major problem on Earth, why don't they just call the other Avengers and the rest of you know, the S.H.I.E.L.D. guys? And so that didn't feel wrong in this one, that, you know, it didn't feel like there'd been a whole lot of stuff happening on Earth, and why the hell hadn't they got around to calling S.H.I.E.L.D.? So let's discuss the visual effects now. And let's open with some of the stuff that I think highlights how well the physical effects team did on this job, which is when we have Natalie's character, Jane, going to find the sort of spatial anomaly of which shoes fall through. There's a terrific scene in that where there's a cement truck that's kind of hovering. You know the shot I'm talking about there, Matt?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
How do you think they did it?
Well, I'm assuming, but I haven't read much. I'll be honest. I haven't read anything about the effects on this movie because there hasn't been much put forward yet with regards to how certain things were done. But my assumption with the vehicle, the cement truck, is that it's, a prop truck that is, or maybe it's even a real truck, but it's on some kind of a system where it's mounted on one end and it's hoisted up and then it's rotated and then that object is removed, would be my guess.
It is, in fact, done like that. And it's a really impressive rig. I've seen behind-the-scenes stuff of it. And, you've got this enormous concrete truck that can just lift up and seem to float and spin at the touch of obviously it's pre-programmed to kind of do that. But I was pretty impressed with that because I imagined that you'd do something like that, with CG, and you'd just build a facade for the front where he's touching it, but the rest of it would just be a giant floating CG.
Yeah, that's cool that they actually did it with a real vehicle across the board. And I think, you know, I seem to remember too, wasn't that in like a long time ago? Well, not, I can't say a long time ago, a year plus ago. Wasn't there a teaser that had that truck in it. I felt like when I saw it, I felt like I'd seen it before. I was like, oh, you know, that's so familiar. And I couldn't help but think that maybe there
I'll
was
defer
a...
to Ian. Ian, do we...
I think it might have been something shown at Comic-Con or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I'd seen it maybe, or maybe it was at Seagraph or something like where I, it was really, really familiar. And I was like, huh, it's interesting. And I thought, you know, it was really successful. And that whole sequence actually was really fun. In that warehouse, it really, it felt like it was lifted almost directly out of the Miyazaki, movie Spirited Away, where the kids are playing and they discover that kind of, area where there's all this kind of, you know, kind of magical anti-gravity stuff going on. And it felt like it was really straight out of that world. It was cool.
I loved the whole shoe thing. But then especially when he grabbed the car keys and it was happening in the background, I was like, that's the car keys, just as she was saying it. I thought it was great. Sorry, go on.
I kind of like that as well, the effects at least around there, because they it is magic. It's portholes and things like that. But they felt very physical, like the rain, for example, that wasn't hitting Natalie Portman's character, Jane. There's something about that which seemed so practical, yet clearly they've got some kind of digital intervention in there.
Yeah, yeah. I've got to say, is it now, what was her assistant, sister, sidekick?
Darcy.
Darcy. Okay, so Darcy did steal the show a bit in that section, I thought, because she was just... That's Kate Dennings, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kat Dennings, yep.
Right, Kat Dennings, thanks. Sorry, I'm not good on names. But yeah, she. I thought she was really, really good. She, yeah, she cracked me up. Anyway, so I think the nice thing about that is that when you've got a portal thing, most people tend to go for the watery imagery that we got used to with kind of a Stargate, which at the time I think was, you know, a knockout idea of doing a visual effect of water but putting it on the side. But, you know, it was just, it just felt kind of fresh, non-threatening, but by the same token, curious. And it it did give us a really reasonable way to solve a later plot problem. In other words, sometimes with those things, you know, like sort of, oh, that looks interesting, that might come in handy later, and that solves a huge problem. This didn't feel that way. So when they started discovering the shoes and had found the way back and she got the cell service later in the film, I thought it just worked super well.
Yeah, that was a really set that up. That was a super unexpected plot turn for me. I just sort of had the assumption that, like, oh yeah, that stuff just vanished and whatever. Like it was just kind of a gag, a one-off gag. And then to have it come back in the story, I thought that was really great. Really surprised me as well. And it was, it felt clever and it felt like a fresh reveal, you know, like it didn't feel like some old trick that they pulled out of the book. Although I guess it kind of is a little bit, you know, they sort of plant those, seeds early in the story, but the way they dealt with it was, it felt, it really, it was clever. You know, it totally got me. I didn't see it coming at all.
Yeah. And I think also you need the visual effects to play a strong enough role that you don't get, you don't read the subtext of you're just setting this up for later. Yep. So they had to play that whole scene out so it had validity in its own right, which I think is why the rain thing kind of worked well, because we didn't come back to the rain thing. So there were sort of enough things happening that we just accepted that that wasn't setting up for something later in the film. And then when it did play out, it played out rather well. And then there's, of course, the trans... Well, I don't know what you'd really call it, really. I was going to say transportation, but it isn't really. Whatever it is that gets them to Asgard and Thor. And there's a lot of humor there. I'm not going to dwell on that because I want to dwell on the visual effects. But as I said, from my point of view, once they got to the Asgard, it actually looked a lot better. It looked less plasticky. Mm-hmm. It looked like a better quality render in terms of detailing, in terms of the light play, and then the art direction of the buildings, while still pretty out there in terms of, you know, World Trade Center, World Fair kind of futuristic visions of you know, Disneyland-esque stuff. It just felt a lot more grounded. And do we know who did the buildings and the kind of environments on the home planet?
Yeah, that was D-Neg. So Double Negative just, I think, really hit it out of the park with those environments. And I kind of think it's interesting. D-Neg seems to be one of the big shops that's a go-to shop for big environments. If you think about the last two Harry Potter films, they really did a lot of Hogwarts for the battle, and they did Huge City in Total Recall, and they also did Metropolis in Man of Steel. And it just feels like, you know, they're getting a bit of a reputation for large scale environments where you're basically seeing every bit of the city. You know, they're not just map paintings or whatever. They're fly throughs and destruction, and it just seems like that's Dineg's, or one of Dineg's specialities at the moment.
Yeah, well, actually, if we trace it back, I mean, Batman Begins is where I think that sort of skill base built out. And I totally agree that Dineg is one of the major houses in the world, and definitely, you know, if you want to have a believable environment. I mean, I think there are a couple of places that can pull off a city. I wouldn't say that they were alone in being able to do that.
No,
I think we've seen, you know, Weta and ILM both pull off some really big environments. But yeah, I totally. In terms of today's cities in particular, you get really good stuff from Dineg. And so it was good to see them doing kind of a more futuristic kind of one. Now, Dineg was a major contributor to the film, but only one of several, right?
Yeah, there's a as is the case with a lot of these Marvel films, they have several shops on there. And I'll just run through them. Like, the overall supervisor was Jake Morrison. And then Dineg did Asgard and, I'm going to say it wrong, but Svartalfheim, which is the dark elf planet. And they also did a lot of the work when the elves are attacking Greenwich. And then just listing the other shops on it, we had Luma Pictures, Method Studios, and Blur, which did the prologue. And also they had an in-house team.
Oh, hang on. When you say the prologue?
Blur did that section right at the beginning of the film where the dark elves are fighting 5,000 years ago against the Ygarde. Yeah. But they also did those main on end titles, which I really liked. You know,
I thought they were cracking. What do you think, Matt? Did you like those end titles? The ones that look like paintings?
Oh, I thought that was great. And I thought I really loved how that was one of the things I was going to mention tonight was the aesthetic of it, the way they sort of the application, how they sort of appear, and then how there was some parallax too, so they kind of had a dimensionality to them that I didn't see the movie in 3D, I should say, but even in 2D, the parallax shift in the painted stuff, it was cool. That's one of the things I think that Marvel does really well is they really do create a kind of a flashiness, but that's often tasteful with regards to the closing credits. I mean, I think they've done different things that are also equally interesting in the Iron Man films, and then of course the really great extreme close-ups that were rendered for the closing of the Avengers movie, which were just super strong.
But they were different, the closing sequences of the Avengers film, equally artistically great, but just a very different style.
Totally, and yeah. I mean, they do something different every time. Yeah, completely agree. Yeah, it had that kind of really neat abstract kind of, you know, very painterly, you know, sort of brushstroke type quality to it. And it was really cool.
Looking at those, and I was just trying to work out, did they just get someone who was a really good artist to do them, or have they done some kind of image processing as the feed into them? Sorry to derail you there, Ian, but I just thought they just were so good, those end titles.
Yeah, they were. I'm really interested, Matt, that you didn't see it in 3D but still got that parallax shift, because that's what I really loved about those titles was in 3D you could almost see the brushstrokes, or you could in 3D, but it's great that it still continued through to the 2D version.
Yeah, there was enough of a shift in which the sort of the layers were comped together. There was enough of a shift going on in terms of a slight movement of the camera such that you did get to see the parallax. And it wasn't that we didn't, you know, it was just we saw it in the afternoon and just went and checked it out, and it just happened to be playing, you know, in two theaters, one 2D and one 3D. And by the time we got to the theater, it was like, oh, I guess we're seeing the 2D one, you know. So it just seemed like, you know, what's the big diff? But it would be interesting to have seen that in 3D. I bet that even it was probably much more accentuated.
Now, I interrupted you, Ian, when you were going through the company, so I don't miss out on the other ones.
Oh, well, that was about it. But also, I think the third floor did a great job on previs on this film, you know, with so many effects. I just wanted to give a shout out to them.
Yeah, because they've now teamed up, what, with Framestore for the London operation. Because they're obviously based in LA, and we've been to their LA offices, and they're awesome and cool and high up and fun to photograph. But they're actually also set up in partnership with Framestore in London, am I right?
Yeah, I think that they kind of have an operation there that started with Gravity, because they were literally doing previs, you know, in 2011, 10, 11, all the way back then for Gravity, and just sort of have stayed there to do work on these sorts of films like Thor.
We should also do a shout out for Sheena, who's a professor and visual effects supervisor first and foremost, but she's also a professor and has contributed over at fxphd.com, obviously my home base, because she was involved in doing additional photography. And Sheena is a terrific VFX supervisor in her own right. Do you have more info on Sheena's role, Ian?
I don't actually, in particular for Sheena's stuff, but another person who I should mention as well was Steph Soretti, who did some second unit VFX photography too. So it's always a big, you know, collaboration with this stuff.
Yes, Sheena's ex-Sony, where she was running high-speed compositing for a while before she became a supervisor, and has done a bunch of stuff, especially with Ridley Scott. And it's great to see her, because apart from that, I think she's a great person. It's great to see strong female supervisors in the industry. I throw you to agree, Matt. We could definitely do with a bit more balancing of the male-female.
Yeah, totally. I think that I remember Sheena from ILM, and you know, she was always awesome, totally great. And I think the more we see of... I mean, I know I worked with, Jessica Norman on The Watchmen. She was a supervisor, and then there was Ellen Poon from ILM and Karen Ansel, I think a fellow Aussie, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we don't want women promoted just because they're women. We just want to have really good women who are promoted because they're really good supervisors to balance out, you know, to help the industry a bit more. And also, I think there's an important aspirational role for, speaking as a father of two daughters, that, you know, you want to see women in those artistic, technical roles as a beacon, I guess, to younger girls to say, hey, well, that's something that that I could do, and not shy away from maths. I guess I threw that at you, Matt, because you're in a educational kind of context.
Oh, totally. Well, you know, in the department in which I teach, too, the ratio of male to female students is heavily weighted in favor of female students. So we have many more women pursuing their degree than we do men. So it's really an interesting shift. A demographic shift, maybe, that's taking place, at least here right now in the area in which I'm teaching, which is pretty exciting. But yeah, and I think, you know, the field has largely been a male-dominated field for a number, and cinema in general, I think, has been this way, Hollywood cinema. And I think it's due to a number of factors, but when it comes to visual effects, I think a lot of it comes out of just the kinds of films that generally tend to have effects seem to be the ones that pique the interest more of the sort of the young male mind in ways, maybe, if you follow what I'm saying. And I think that not to say that that there aren't women who are interested in those films as well, but I think part of the discrepancy could come in part due to the fact that, you know, I would suspect that, you know, more young boys are interested in Transformers than young women, right? For what it's worth.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's also in of itself changing, because obviously visual effects are no longer in just the kind of, you know,
absolutely
boy type films, and have an increasingly interesting role in telling stories that are, you know, closer to an aesthetic that may be of interest to, you know, cross-gender kind of things.
Totally, totally, yeah.
So let's get back to, we're now at Asgard. There's a huge attack that takes place, and I'm just jumping around a little bit, but, you know, we're not trying to recount it shot for shot. But it was a good action sequence. I've had the benefit of being able to see the previews of that entire sequence, and it's remarkably close to the previews. But I thought the attack sequence and the nature of that, in terms of, you know, things being destroyed, it reminded me a bit of Star Wars in a good way. Some of the good kind of stuff that we remember from those attack type sequences in Star Wars things, because, you know, you had things shooting at each other, things blowing up, a sense of, you know, kind of dogfighting maneuvers to get somewhere. I really kind of enjoyed that sequence. I especially liked the crash at the end into kind of the palace. It had a real presence to it that didn't just look like we were throwing rocks at the screen to get 3D artifacts. Ian, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. And I think part of that attack sequence that I really liked too was the actual design and style of animation of those little ships. I like the big ship as well, which I think is called the Ark. But they had those sort of blade-shaped harrow ships. And I kind of liked what D'Neg did with those in terms of getting them between buildings and avoiding laser blasts. And it was almost like, right, this is the design of the ship. This is how you're going to have to animate it to make it look interesting and move in a certain way. And I thought they did a really neat job of that.
Yeah, I think they used visual effects when they needed to. I mean, that really was a big effect sequence. I mean, the Captain America cameo was basically just editing, right? I mean, it was just hysterically funny because it was just well edited. But there was no, and by the way, that was another Josh written scene, but there was no sense in that that you were just, you know, wasting time with a lot of visual effects. You didn't need to, right? Just keep cutting backwards and forwards and it was funny. In this, we wanted to see something big and spectacular. But I think the other thing, Matt, is we covered quite a lot of ground over the city. And I think that's always a really good feeling for, you know, you have a big action sequence like that. You want to cover ground and have some really good wide shots that appreciate stuff at the same time as having those kind of more intense close-up shots that give it like an energy and a pacing.
Sorry, are you saying of the city of Asgard?
Yeah, yeah. When the attack came and the ships, you know, ended up breaking into the main, I guess, palace.
Yeah, I mean, shattering, you know, the columns. In talking about the city earlier, I think you guys both make a great point about the work of D'Neg, and I do think that D'Neg as a facility in rendering cityscapes, be it for the, you know, the Batman films, of which I'm not a huge fan, of course, but
oh, please come on, let go of it. Oh my god, then, you poor then, demented.
And man. then in
well, it's been fun having you on the show, man.
And then in Asgard too, I think they did achieve something different here, which was a more kind of photorealistic rendering of, you know, the sort of the pipe organ pizza palace and all the kind of goofy buildings of Asgard, which I think it definitely did look much better in this rendering than the previous iteration. But with regards to the pieces of the ship and the kind of weird, I don't know what those things were, those like almost like these, you know, kitchen utensils that sort of flew out of the larger ship as they circled the city. Those are the kinds of effects that I think they were really well rendered. They were well done. In most cases, there were a few things that it's always my gripe. I feel like on every VFX show, the stuff where they get in the Viking longship, craft, you know, and Thor and Loki and whoever else is sort of flying around in that boat. Sometimes when they're on the boat and the background is whizzing past them, at least in the 2D version, it looks super compy. You know what I mean?
Oh, really?
In the sense that it the depth of field at times, the lensing, the CG lensing in some of the shots, both on the boat, but then also of those kind of weird black, you know, forks or whatever that are flying around, the lensing looks so strange, like that it would go to a really like a shallow depth of field in a shot where you would think if it were really happening it wouldn't be shot that way. And for me, I think maybe dimensionally, if you're watching it in 3D it looks good, but when I'm watching it in 2D it looks forced, like it looks like the background is being thrown out of focus and the foreground is being thrown slightly out of focus in a way that seems really unnatural, that you would never be able to achieve in a true sort of cinematic way if you were actually shooting it for real. And so those kinds of choices for me visually, they take me kind of out of the film. Like they create shots that are, I mean, it's kind of a stretch to say this because, yeah, it's a stretch and it's a fantasy movie, sci-fi fantasy type of movie, in that Asgard isn't a real place. These ships aren't real. But at the same time, the camera movement and the choice of the way it sort of, the cinematography choices, the virtual cinematography, I think needs to adhere to certain rules. Otherwise, I don't know, it feels more like a video game than a movie. And I think those shots...
Yeah, see, I didn't think it did. In 3D, I didn't think it looked like a video game. I mean, it's a really interesting point you make, and I don't dispute it for a second. It just didn't in 3D. At least it didn't for me.
No, and me neither. And you know one thing that I think helped with that, in particular when they escaped Asgard or escaped the palace, you know, when they broke out of that throne room, was you had the cockpit shots of Thor and Loki, but in the cockpit, you could actually also see the exterior, or you could see Geo or some sort of model of the exterior. And because they didn't keep having to cut from outside sort of to inside the cockpit, it kind of felt more immersive. And it didn't have that sort of video game feel in that way.
Yeah, look, I mean, I now really want to go and see Thor 2 in mono because I guess I can on DVD, but it just didn't feel compy, which is really interesting because there was a little bit that I was thinking this was set up for the 3D because there's some big, like especially the shot where they go through at the end and he says, right. You know, kind of a V kind of slit of building that he flies in. If anyone could do it, it'd be easy kind of thing. I thought there was some nods to 3D, but the rest of it, it just seemed kind of good.
Well, and I think those big, that's interesting. I mean, I feel like I should see it in 3D then. Maybe that was really what it was intended for and that it succeeds in that way. And I mean, there were good shots in it, even in 2D. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't like the whole thing was bad. I think there were just some that really kind of, they took me out of it a touch. And I think that, the other thing for me is that type of, when the ships are first flying around the city, the alien ships, and they're kind of blowing stuff up and causing havoc, that kind of sequence, it really reminds me of, I think it's Attack of the Clones that opens with this big space battle that's really long and is really very well done on a technical level.
Well, because Steven Spielberg directed it.
Right, but I would say that those kinds of sequences that are told in that way where they're, I think they're difficult to watch and difficult to follow. Like, I don't know that they're very successful for me as an audience member. Like, I don't know that I feel that those are the most kind of compelling types of visual effects shots. They're big, they're audacious, they're ambitious, but the kind of high speed, space battle kind of stuff, they don't have the same kind of grounding that I feel like you had in sort of space battles in, you know, the old days. And I mean, maybe I sound like now the old man of the group here, but like the old days of the, you know, the motion control and the optical compositing of, like, you know, the space battle in, say, Return of the Jedi or something, where the moves are not quite as extreme.
Well, yeah, because they couldn't be, right? Because you couldn't pull them off with the camera rigs to models and miniatures the way you can with 3D, when you can sort of literally do anything. I'll just totally take your point on that. I did like the attack. I found the escape slightly worse, basically because I'm kind of sick of aircraft that seems, or alien vehicles that seem to have the most incomprehensible user interfaces known to man. And, you know, really that's your advanced technology and that's what you want. You have to, like, use both hands, stand up and look at 400 screens at once. I mean, you know, but hey, you know, I have other complaints. Is anyone else concerned that elves are getting a bad name? I mean, really, like, between this and Lord of the Rings and stuff, like, you know, just because these guys are ugly doesn't make them bad people. I mean, sorry, bad aliens. Okay. Hey, one of the things I wanted to flag, changing subjects, is, and I thought this was really interesting, it's the next bit of the sort of film, as it were, the choice of going to shoot in Iceland for the scene that followed and the kind of those bleak volcanic landscapes. Look, you know, it's easier, I guess. They went and shot at Stonehenge for real and, you know, shot there before the public opening hours. And I think that's great because it would have been easier, I'm sure, to have produced some rocks on a Californian kind of hillside and pretended, but most of us, I think, know what Stonehenge kind of looks like, and it's great when they go for that authenticity. But going to the middle of some Icelandic, in the middle of nowhere, really said, hey, it was a good idea to get the guy from Game of Thrones. because those landscapes just give you such production value.
Oh, you bet. You bet your life. I mean, like, I was in Iceland a few years back and traveled all over the country, and they shot a bunch of footage, I know, for this movie at... is it Godafoss or Dentafoss, which sounds like dental floss, but which is one of the largest waterfalls in Europe, I believe, right? And they shot a bunch of footage there as well that they inserted, I think, into the larger cityscape, if I'm not mistaken. But those huge volcanic plains, I know they shot a ton of stuff there for Prometheus a few years back, but you do get huge production value from some of those very alien landscapes. And it really is, I mean, you drive around the country in Iceland, which you actually can drive literally around the country in a day. It's on the ring road. And as you get into the interiors where you see some of these more interesting landscapes. But I think that, shooting in Iceland for any kind of a fantasy film or a science fiction film is just, it's gold. And I think it's so interesting and it's exciting to see filmmakers going out and shooting big sequences on location. I was reminiscing about this recently with a friend of mine about how it felt like in the 70s there were so many films that were shot in exotic locales. You know, they would go out and get all this production value by going to, you know, really interesting places, thinking back on films like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark or Close Encounters or Star Wars, you know, the first films and stuff, where they would travel to these really interesting sort of, you know, previously unutilized locations. And Iceland has kind of become that, at least for a time, as a place for filmmakers to go and really get some amazing footage. And I totally applaud that. Anytime I see a production spending money in that way to go out and get something really exotic out in the real world.
Like there are shots, Ian, I think you'd agree, where you've got basically like two or three characters and it could have looked cheap because there wasn't, you know, sets and there was like, okay, there was a big alien ship, but it was like way over there and out of the shot most of the time. And the cinematography combined with the just environment made it look epic.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, the whole idea is that this world they're on, Svartalfheim, is kind of dying or dead because of that last battle. And it just, you know, Iceland's perfect for that, isn't it? The only thing I was going to say about Iceland, though, which I think is interesting, is that it's being a choice in a lot of films and TV shows recently. You know, you mentioned Prometheus, Matt, but also a lot of Oblivion was shot there too.
Game of Thrones.
I'm curious, like, how many more until people go, oh, that's Iceland, you know? Or
well,
may already be saying that.
I think after the GFC, Iceland's pretty cheap to film in, right? 300,000 yeah. people there, and they owed like $10 billion each, kind of thing. So, any foreign currency is a worthwhile thing. I think I'd give the Icelandic guys as much. I mean, hey, if I was in Iceland, I'd welcome filmmakers with every arm.
No, absolutely. And I love Iceland, but I'm curious, you know, when they can't find another different angle or view of the country.
What do we think of the special effects makeup, the prosthetics and stuff that were on our dark, evil elves and warlords and their pop-up, trained pet monster?
I like the big bad monster who, like the guy who took the thing that got inserted in his... in his gullet.
Yeah.
And I think when he transformed, like that whole sequence, the fire and stuff of him, when he falls over and he kind of burns and then he comes back up and he's like that kind of weird, like, uber Viking monster killer elf. I thought that stuff was pretty cool. And I did like, not so much the lead elf. I'm not a big fan of elves. I'll say that at the get-go, but I did really like the weird, kind of creepy, nondescript masks that the elf guys wore that made them seem way more menacing to me. The sort of the elf soldiers. And I kind of dug that as a costuming choice.
You and I just can't agree, can we?
You didn't like that?
I thought they were Doctor Who. They were like funny ears and masks, and they looked like they were wearing black leotards with bits of stuck on. Like I thought they were the least successful costumes.
It did remind me a little bit of...
I thought they were scary.
I thought the lead guy, on the other hand, big-eared though he was suitably...
he just seemed like a Bond villain or something from, you know, like old Bond.
He seemed like a Bond villain? Where was the cat?
Yeah.
What are you talking about, you
He was the cat. That's the thing. He was the Bond with those pointed ears. But I thought
it's the albino one.
There were moments where when the elves were on screen and they were doing their elven, you know, bad business, they reminded me of... For some reason, I started thinking of that movie from... I think it's from the 80s.
Lord of the Rings.
No. I hate those movies. I've never watched them all the way through. But
oh wow, we're just really going there today, aren't we?
Sorry, I just had to drop that bomb out there. I was thinking of the movie from the 80s. I think it's called Crawl. You guys ever seen that? Where there's
With Dolph Lundgren, is it?
Is it? I don't know. It's like some guy, and he's... It's like a fantasy sci-fi
really
movie.
Really descended into Dolph Lundgren films?
No, no. It's I don't know if it's Dolph Lundgren. It's like...
Oh, it might not be.
But anyway, it reminded me of this movie Crawl from the 80s, like the elves with their masks. It was such a strange... just elves in general, dark elves too. Like, what does that mean? I don't know. I guess that they're dark, therefore they're bad. And yeah, it was a strange choice. Elves were a strange character choice.
I must admit, I have lost track of the evil guys in this universe. Are these the same evil guys? And please send me hate mail that I don't know this, but are these the same evil guys that we saw at the end of Avengers with the little steps going up to the thing? Or are these different evil guys?
I think they're different. And the ones at the end of the Avengers, those are some of the worst bad guys, I think, in the history of bad guy movie design. Those were so shoddy. As the big, like, weird flying creature was cool, but those other ones were so bad. And the elves, I think, are difficult too. I think that there has yet to be a formidable and powerful and meaningful group of baddies in the Marvel universe, for my tastes.
I think you have a problem when you don't let them emote. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think it's really good when it's very easy. You know, like most aliens look robotic, or, you know, they're not people. But it'd be really interesting to make one where you actually had a sense of them being not just mindless, you know, thugs or, you know, expendable security guards from the, you know, Starship Enterprise. I mean, they just don't have any sort of sense of we care about any of these guys. So that you can kill them all and not have anyone be bad. I mean, you don't want your lead character in a Marvel comic to sort of just kill people that anyone cares about, because then they would just be a bad person, right? Not a good person defending. But so that's sort of, I guess, one of the reasons you have to go that way. But yeah, no, I'd like to see complexity. But I guess you could argue Loki is that, right? Loki has enormous complexity. We really care about him.
But he doesn't. So he also doesn't feel like he's going to do anything that's too bad either, because there's a certain...
He did bugger up New York a little bit with the whole, you know, thing in Avengers. Did you not watch that one either?
Yeah, I guess so.
What?
Oh, I did want to say...
Nothing wrong.
And what the outcome of this film is. I mean, he's going to do some bad shit.
He's taken...
Yeah, I didn't understand.
How did the king? Spoilers alert, sorry.
How did he... I thought he died, right? And then all of a sudden he's alive. I don't know. That was weird to me too. Like, how did
he's a shapeshifter and has that sort of illusion thing. So he's obviously double-crossed or...
Can I bring up another aspect of the effects in this movie that I've totally dug?
You dug or you...
Oh, I absolutely loved. Yeah, it was great.
Okay, good. Yep,
so
no, good. That would be good.
Two things.
I'd like that.
One broad thing and one very specific. The broad thing is, I think this movie has some, not groundbreaking, but really very well done and incredibly well executed particle work. There's so much great particle work and destruction and effects sims in this movie that I really enjoyed. And it felt like it was like a nonstop cavalcade of particles. And I absolutely dug it. And then the one effect that specifically that I actually thought was just really cool, because it was something that felt like something I hadn't seen before, was the weird singularity grenade. I dug the way that he would throw
that
those out.
That was way cool.
Yeah.
That
and
was cool.
That looked so neat and was such a, like, anytime one of those things got activated, once you saw what one could do, it was freaky. You were just like, oh man, like, don't get near that thing. Like, it felt, it had so much really frightening menace where whatever was in its path, it disappeared. And that was so messed up. I don't know. I really loved it.
I totally agree. And I think the example to be given is the throne in his father's throne, when it gets, you know, the bomb thrown in that general direction and it sucks part of the throne away. Spectacular visual effects work, really good particle work. And I agree, it was like the thing about it that was really nice is that you quite often go the other way and you don't see what's happening because it's just a cloud of dust
right,
and stuff.
Right.
This one we could sort of watch it destruct.
Yeah, you could see enough through the kind of spinning bits of energy. You could see just what was inside, and what was happening inside was like, it was disturbing, you know, it was unpleasant.
Yeah.
Although it was weird that the throne then magically reappeared at the end of the movie, so I'm not quite sure.
I don't think it magically reappeared.
They just they rebuilt it.
Well, yeah, that doesn't seem unreasonable. Enough time had passed. It's a throne after all.
I guess so.
You know, I'd send in the janitor squad and get that sorted pretty quick. What are you talking about?
Okay, cool.
So it's completely reasonable.
I think
it's valid. God.
But I thought that stuff was really good, and I thought all that work that they achieved in that was really solid. The one, if I was going to cite any of the effects, I think that maybe aside from the comp issue I talked about, and then you know the plot stuff, I'm kind of making a goof of some of it, but I think the other thing that I wasn't sure about, and I was wondering how it played in 3D, was in the film when the big evil elf ship arrives on Earth, and it's coming on land in, I guess they're in London, right off the Thames or something. Yep.
No, it's Greenwich.
Oh, Greenwich. Okay, right. So it's coming onto land, and there is a large amount of water and dust and debris that collides with people, right, that are running away, like in sort of typical Godzilla movie fashion. And some of that stuff in 2D, I thought, like, some of the composites of the debris encapsulating the people felt like it didn't feel quite as successful as some of the other stuff. It felt, again, a little bit more like it was a real 2D looking effect, and I was wondering if you guys noticed any of that stuff.
I thought that worked all right for me in 3D. I liked that it started in the river and sort of buckled the edge and that kind of worked. No, I don't know. I didn't really notice anything like that pop out as a bad sort of mix of particle and destruction and people running to and fro.
Yeah, I was okay with that. It's interesting, these things, because a lot of the things you're flagging, you know, it seems like they've got real issues vis-a-vis 3D versus 2D.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, yeah, is that could be the primary issue.
Yeah. And you know, it's hard to know that because I certainly hadn't watched both. So,
now, what about the another thing I was curious about that stuck out to me and I only feel like I don't want to sound like I'm being the wet blanket on this movie because there's so much great stuff in it. But the one thing that I wasn't one other thing I wasn't that crazy about was the design of the interface on the handheld device that plays a pivotal role in that same sequence where they're sort of, and in the warehouse sequence too, where they're detecting these readings and these anomalies. I don't know. Did you guys, did any of those things stick out to you at all? The user interface design.
It wasn't so much. I was just obsessed with, you know, how convenient it was that they had a detection device that could be used as an ultimate weapon that just happened to have been invented by a crazy guy running around naked. You know, that was felt like a bit of a plot convenience. Hey, look, we just happened to have this thing.
I totally agree, but I do think that as a convenient plot item, I do think that the kind of craziness that ensued at the end of the movie with the kind of the convergence and then all these different portals opening and closing, I did think that was kind of awesome. Like it was so
it was fun.
It was so nutty, you know, like so many weird things were going on.
You know what I really liked about that, Matt, was that when they went through a portal, it just cut to the next scene really quickly, and they were sort of projected through them. It wasn't sort of like they needed a bridge to go through. I think that made the sequence a lot more frenetic and fast, you know, rather than sort of, oh, now we're going through the portal.
Yeah, and it felt like it would be a really hard thing to edit and to tell, you know, like in a script, like it's so frenetic and so fast that it seems like you could lose the audience really quickly and have people kind of not know where they are or what's going on. But I actually thought, you know, for me, the guy who's usually kind of slow at picking up where we're at, like I was able to follow that really well. I thought it was cool. It worked out. And it made for a really frenetic and kind of exciting, third act, I thought.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It was set up enough in the beginning that we knew where we were going. It was mentioned and used again in the middle, so it wasn't just coming out of nowhere, which is why I say I think the film didn't feel like it was rewrite central, because things seemed to be, you know, enough, notwithstanding my problem with these rods that never seemed to need to stand up, even though it was very important that you stood them up. Apart from the rods, that wasn't just a sort of a sudden, oh, look, I just happened to have invented one of these earlier. Oh, awesome. That'll just solve all our problems and make everything go back to normal. Thanks. Because my biggest problem with, I've got to say, Doctor Who, and I'm not dishing on the show, it's just that there's been a number of those episodes in the last series or two where it looks all hopeless right until the last second, and then it's just you hit the reset button and it all just goes back to normal. Like, oh, thank the Lord for that. It's great. You know, like, just if I just cross this beam here and boom, everything's fine. Oh, okay. You know, in the closing seconds, it just seems you get in an awful lot of trouble and then just suddenly get out of it. And those pillar things, yeah, okay, they gave us a good reason for things flying around, and so that kind of solved the day. The whole alignment with the planets thing, I did stop and say to myself, if that was actually happening, isn't that going to be about one of the biggest pieces of news since New York, if not bigger? Because, you know... you know, okay, not many people died, but, you know, there was this up in the sky alignment of multiple things, and, you know, it seemed like a pretty big event. There were quite a few witnesses, not dead. But, yeah, we'll see what happens. Okay, so I think we've covered most of the visual effects stuff. We actually already jumped to that end sequence. And is there any shots that you particularly loved or hated in the scene, in the film?
I did want to shout out Luma for the frost monster. Which kind of obviously is in the first film, but this is like a baby version or a smaller version that gets portaled into Earth. And then, you know, we do see it in that really cool end sequence as well.
Yeah. Very bird, cool end sequence. Yeah.
But I just thought that, there you go, there's a crazy creature, and they did a good job of bringing that to Earth and making it sit in the environment. Something would have been really hard to do.
Yeah. Are you watching Marvel Shield? Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Matt?
You know, my son is totally into it. He's digging that show. So we are, as a family, watching that with him every weeknight that comes on. I think it's on Tuesday nights, and here in the U.S. anyway. And he has been digging it. And, you know, it's fun. I think it has some, you know, some... It's a TV show, right? And it has some... problems as a narrative, and they still have that ridiculous flying aircraft carrier, which I'll never understand why that thing exists. But
hold your hat, because I think it makes a fairly big comeback in the next Captain America.
Yeah, I've seen not the trailer for that one, but yeah, I mean, it's okay, and they're not doing a whole lot, at least at present, to weave any of this sort of the cinematic narrative into the larger films, other than very anecdotally in a few brief dialogue exchanges. But the episodes so far seem largely encapsulated as individual stories that I think are dovetailing into a larger narrative arc that will probably connect the two worlds, kind of TV and the film worlds. But I was going to say one other shot that I think is really great in the movie, and it really stood out as a really strong composite and lighting and rendering job, was when the alien ship, the big T-shaped ship, does finally arrive there in Greenwich, and it parks. There's a great vista of the ship, like a big wide shot where it's like a helicopter shot, like with it in the foreground and the rest of the sort of city, I think, in the background. Or was that in London? I feel like that was in London, though. I don't know why. I seem to remember the big Ferris wheel and all that. But it is it was so well rendered and so well lit. And it's like a real, you know, kind of diffuse, typical sort of UK kind of day where it's like there's not any really heavy direct sunlight. But there was a nice amount of kind of atmosphere, like sort of low hanging light clouds passing just in front of the very black kind of charcoal-y element of the ship, and it really tied it in really nicely. And it was a pretty long shot too. I mean, I think we're talking, you know, 600 frames or something, maybe 500 frames or something like that. It felt really long. And you got a really good chance to look at it. And it was so successfully tied together that it was one of those shots too that gave so much presence of both place as well as really high production value. So they were getting a lot of bang for their buck in my book with a shot that was, you know, not necessarily, you know, the most complex, but that they achieved something that was so photoreal that it was really just a pleasure to look at.
Yes.
And you know what else I think works in that sequence too, is that those ships come to Earth, but they don't blow up London. Because I think in a couple of recent films, we've seen a lot of basically destroyed cities. You know, we've been seeing that for quite a long time now. I quite liked, and it was probably the portals that meant that they didn't destroy all of the city. I quite liked that didn't happen, you know, because we've kind of seen that before. So it feels like they deliberately moved away from that, which was a sort of a good ending.
Yeah, London is the sort of, you know, poor man's New York for blowing up these days in films. There was a little run there that Chicago had of getting blown up and a little bit of LA with 2012. But yeah, generally speaking, if you don't want to blow up New York, you want to blow up London, which, you know, it's partly because they've got such a great Ferris wheel, which always works really well, and there's water and all the things you want to blow up. But I agree. I don't think I need to see London or New York blown up again. Do you think we've had the point where we've got like disaster porn fatigue, that we're just not that interested in seeing a ton of shots of major cities? I mean,
I think we have. But the criticism of Man of Steel, wasn't it, that there's so much of the city's blown up and all these people are going to die, but they don't really deal with that. And then Superman has such a conscience about killing Zod. And that really, for some reason, really went around.
Can I just do a rat hole here? Like, if you've got kids, you'll know about The Way It Should Have Ended. What's it called?
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing that's on YouTube? Yeah, okay. Yeah. How It Should Have Ended. And their one for Man of Steel, I mean, it's had like 8 million views or whatever it is, but it's just hysterically funny. Because in that, I don't know why we didn't hit this in the VFX show, but it's like this guy has come from outer space who wants Superman. If only there was someone I could ask about this guy. If there was only some way I could find out, like, oh, my father, somebody I could talk to. No, I won't bother talking to him. I'll just go and do. It's like, it was just like such a classic plot hole that show is very good at finding a plot hole and just driving a comic wedge right through.
I just couldn't help but think at the end of that movie too, like, you know, God, like, what if you're like an insurance adjuster, you know, after the destruction of Metropolis? Like, can you imagine? Like, I mean, what a horrible, like, it would be the worst possible job. Sad.
Anyway, yes, it was very, very funny. How it should have ended on Man of Steel just cracked me up. I'm sure they'll do a good one on this. They did a good one on Avengers as well. Okay, so looking forward, we've got a few really cool films coming down the pipe. I'm certainly looking forward to seeing Hunger Games, which I wouldn't have predicted that I would have pre-seeing the first one. But I think, like this film, if you've got a really good actor in the lead role, in this case actress, you know, you can forgive a lot of sort of weird plot things that really don't make any sense.
I love J-Law. She's so cool. She's really good. I just watched again, for the second time, I watched the Silver Linings Playbook again. And she makes that movie. Like, that's just so fun.
Yeah.
She's great.
Yeah, really, really, really good. So there are a lot of good films coming down the pipe. Of course, we've got the second Hobbit film coming before Christmas, and then a lot of stuff happening around Oscar time, especially with, of course, the SciTech Awards and the VFX Oscar. And at the moment, I think we'd probably say that Gravity's looking, well, a shoe-in for a nomination. Let's put it that way at this early stage.
It's going to win.
Gravity doesn't get nominated, then I retire. So stick with us in coming weeks. Again, thank you for those people that commented on the things that we've been doing lately. We do appreciate it. Matt, where can people track you down?
You can always stalk me or find me online at I'm at Virginia Commonwealth University in the School of the Arts. which is, by the way, the number one public art school in the United States. And I can be found where else? On my website, mattwallen.com. And just real quick, a short cross promotion here. I just had my second episode of the Visual Story podcast with Paul Zaddy. And on that episode, he asked me to pick another film, and we do a talk on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I have to say, it's a great conversation, and it's actually a dialogue that I listened back to it just yesterday, and I'm really proud of it. It turned out really good. I think it's a great show, and worth checking out if anybody is a fan of that movie.
When you said public school, what did you call it? The best public arts.
We have been ranked as the number one public art school.
Can you explain what that is? Because just for non-American, those terms aren't ringing.
Yeah, so in the United States, we have public schools and private schools. And private schools are privately funded, privately, private endowments and funding that allows them to function. And then public schools are funded in part by the states in which they exist. So here in Virginia, the Commonwealth of the state of Virginia, taxpayers pay some of the money to finance the running of the university. They pay much less than they used to, but there is a portion of funds that come both from the state as well as from the federal government for public institutions. So it's an effort. Public education is always, it's like sort of one of Ben Franklin's big things way back in the old way back machine, and public education paid for by the citizens through taxes has always been a big part of U.S. Educational culture anyway, and I don't know, something that I firmly believe in. So I don't know. It's cool to be the number one public art school in the country.
Right. Now, I guess the thing that I was just checking, though, is when you talk about a school of the arts, in my country, a school would only be a term used for secondary students under the age of 17 kind of thing, right? Mm. But you tend to use the word school to encompass universities?
Yeah, so a university is composed of colleges within the university system. But at our university, we call the different programs are schools within the university. So we have a school of engineering, we have a school of the arts, and so just the terminology, I guess, is slightly different.
Yeah, and I understood that to be thus, and we certainly have, a school of whatever at universities here. It just sounded like, if you're a non-American, that you were teaching what I'd call high school.
Undergrads and some grad students as well, pursuing either a bachelor's degree, a bachelor of fine arts degree, or a master of fine arts degree.
And Ian?
You can find me on FX Guide. Check out my stuff there. And also my blog, which is vfxblog.com, or on Twitter at vfxblog. And I just wanted to give one last shout out. Something we didn't talk about was the new Marvel logo that's attached to Thor 2.
Oh, yeah.
And that's that was sort of more 3D. You know, they've got that flickering comic book look, but it's a bit more 3D. And I think that was done by Imaginary Forces, who obviously do great stuff.
Yeah, I like the old one. I want to give a shout out, actually, to Todd Cholton, our producer, because I've been very remiss in not flagging him for the last few episodes, and I apologize to Todd unreservedly for that. Todd manages the VFX show for us and has for a long time now, and we really appreciate his contribution. He also produces various dossiers and background information for us to make us sound really, really smart. He himself is a very smart guy, but yes, we'd really appreciate Todd, and I should remember to thank him each and every week, because he does a great contribution to the show, and also to our editing staff, including David in Chicago, who does a huge amount for us, and the rest of the team. So thank you guys for that. We do appreciate it. Obviously, I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter, and you'll find me at FX Guide. Thanks, guys, so much for being with us. We look forward to catching you on the flip side, so keep an eye out on what's happening. And we explained at the outset, we're going to do some more of the live shows. We're not giving up on those. We just want to get the audio solved so we don't make any compromises to the audio podcast by doing the video podcast at the same time. We appreciate your comments in pointing out that experiment was a bit painful to experience firsthand. So we'll try and get that solved offline and then come back online when it's solved. Okay, thanks so much for being with us. Until next time, I'm Mike Simon. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.